Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Good day. Welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Cotillo, the Royal Historical Society. I am a host on the channel. And today I'm pleased and honored to have with us Peter Hitchens. Mr. Hitchens is a writer and journalist with a regular column in the Mail on Sunday. He is also an Orwell Prize winner. And today we are speaking about his book, Phony Victory, The World War to Illusion. Welcome, Mr. Hitchens.
Pleasure to be with you.
Mr. Hitchens, what is the primary thesis of your book?
That the Western world, particularly the winning countries in the Second World War, and most particularly my own country, Great Britain, have constructed a myth about the Second World War, which is dangerous because it is increasingly used as a model for starting new wars of choice. And it's based on a number of misapprehensions and mistakes about what actually happened in World War II, which I seek to correct. My main purpose in writing it was because I was increasingly tired of my country rushing into wars of choice, such as in Iraq and in Libya. And the argument always being that the threat which we faced was a new Hitler, that the leader who wanted to mount the attack was a new Churchill, and that anybody who opposed this attack was a feeble umbrella-waving Neville Chamberlain, who therefore didn't need to be listened to. The whole model, what I call Munich syndrome, the whole model of 1938-1939 as a pattern for going to war seemed to me to have lodged in the public mind and in the minds of politicians in a way which was dangerous. Combine with that a very strong belief, which is not actually justified by the facts, that the United Kingdom and the United States went to war in Europe, particularly to save the Jews of Europe from Hitler. It isn't, alas, true. By winning the war, they did save some of the Jews of Europe, but it wasn't their purpose in fighting the war. It wasn't why they went to war. And indeed, many of the actions of the British government, and to some extent those of the United States government before and during the war, did not in any way help the persecuted and, in many cases, trapped Jews of Europe at all.
To anticipate a little bit something I was going to go later on in our conversation, but since you brought it up, I'll ask you now. Is it the case in the UK, or for that matter in the US or the West in general, that popular opinion believes that we went to war with Hitler's Germany to save European Jewry?
Yes, I think it is very common belief, and I cite as an example of this, and it's very typical, a broadcast made by Prince Charles, the current heir to the British throne, in which he pretty much makes this assumption that it was war fought to save Jews from persecution. It's a very common thing, widely believed. I think if anybody would care to research it, they'd find it was pretty much lodged in the public mind in Britain. I couldn't speak so much for the United States because I don't think that World War II has such a major part in the historical myth of the United States. The only two really important wars in the USA are the Civil War and the Vietnam War, and the Second World War comes up a very poor third after those. But I think that there is a general belief that it was fought for benevolent reasons. It was a benevolent war, and of course it has attracted the description of the good war, partly because, say, of the element in it of defeating a particularly revolting tyranny. The problem with that description as the good war is that in the course of defeating one revolting tyranny, we ended up very heavily appeasing another revolting tyranny in the shape of Joseph Stalin's USSR, to whom we then handed a large portion of Central Europe as his prize.
Again, I don't want to go into this too much, at least not now, but would it be the case that this particular view of World War II, or one of the benevolent outcomes that we, well, not outcomes, but goals that we went to war to save European Jewry, was that popular belief in the UK in, say, up to, say, 1965? Or was that something which came subsequently as the public consciousness of the Holocaust, the extermination of European Jewry by Hitler's Germany, became more prevalent?
Fascinating question, to which I can't give a factual answer because no one's ever done this, any kind of survey work to show, but I would imagine you're right. The prominence in the Western public mind of the Holocaust, so-called, and the, or the Shoah, as I prefer to call it, and the whole issue of the mass murder of European Jews has grown greatly, partly, of course, as we know, as a result of television series and films, since the 1960s, and quite possibly didn't play as much of a part in the myth until then, but it certainly does now. And I would challenge anybody who has any dealings with the public rather than with expert historians to find many people who don't believe that this was one of the reasons why we went to war. People are incredibly vague about history.
And unfortunately, as a trained historian, I'm very familiar with what you're saying on that point. Getting back to the beginnings of the book, in your reading of the Munich Crisis of 1938, I take it you would not agree with historians like, say, Williamson Murray, who posit that, strategically speaking, the Munich settlement, insofar as France and UK did not go to war with Germany in September 1938, was, I think Williamson Murray refers to it as disaster, by simply the fact that Germans were able to take huge amounts of armaments, material from what subsequently became the Czech protectorate, which would not have been the case if war had been fought in 1938. And also, of course, the Czech army, while it was not a first-rate army in the German or French or even British sense, or Soviet sense for that matter, was on, in defensive terms, given the fortifications on the Czech borders with Germany, a formidable opponent, and that front that the Germans did not want was lost once the settlement was agreed to by Chamberlain and Daladier.
Well, I love this argument. I don't think we'll ever settle it, but my own view is heavily influenced by a recent journey I took from Prague to Vienna, which emphasized something I already knew but most people don't know, which is that Vienna is east of Prague. And if you, I traveled across the area which would have been the scene of any war between Germany and Czechoslovakia had such a thing taken place. And of course the fortifications in the Erzgebirge, up in the mountains would have been extremely potent. But the problem was that because of the Anschluss of Austria into the Reich, Germany had far easier borders to cross. And they are utterly undefended and pretty much indefensible. It's very good tank country if you do that journey. I don't think that Czechoslovakia could have defended itself. I think there's a fair amount of evidence that Beneš never wanted to use the army that he possessed. People often don't. And I doubt very much whether he would have fought. And also, had he done so, you'd have to explain to me in some detail what a French army configured for defense and a British army that barely existed and was exercising at the time with broomsticks rather than rifles could have done about it. Also, the British Royal Air Force at that time was pretty much entirely equipped with biplanes as well. I just don't think myself that there was any possibility of Britain and France going to war, and I'm not quite sure how they ever worked themselves in a position where it might have been considered likely. Particularly Britain, which had made at no stage any guarantees of Czechoslovakia.
I have to say that I, in terms of that portion of your argument, I agree with you that there's an expression in French to describe French policy of the period, actually the interwar period as a whole, vis-à-vis France's Central and East European allies, le sang de les autres, translated roughly, the blood of others, meaning yeah. that these allies were, in essence, viewed as substitutes for the Russian steamroller of 1914, and it was meant for them to assist France, not France to assist them when it came to a crunch.
Well, France was in a state of its own illusions at the time. It simultaneously wanted to maintain itself as a great power. It had been one of the victors of 1918, but it really wasn't strong enough nor prepared to make the sacrifices on the scale necessary to enter into another major shooting war with Germany. They had had Verdun, and the line from Verdun to Vichy seems to me to be quite straightforward. They were not willing to make sacrifices of their manhood on that scale again so recently after the previous time. And I don't think that France had ever any intention of charging towards the German border again. It was a disaster when they did it in 1914, and it cost them so much in young manhood that I don't think that the France of 1938 or 1939 or 1940 was ever prepared to do it. They were prepared to fight a defensive war if attacked, and there's many myths about the French performance in the early part of the war. Where they were able to come up against the Germans, they fought very well. But it just wasn't, there was no mood, no political support for a war of aggression.
Nor,
I have to say, was the French army configured for it. They simply weren't prepared for a war of attack.
Now, let me ask you, because there is a school, it's not a major school, it's a relatively minor school, but it's in some interesting and, in some cases, important historians who belong to it. One in his book, The Impact of Hitler, Maurice Cowling, and the other one is the British diplomatic historian John Charmley. As well as a few others, but in essence, their argument is, and I think it's similar to, but I believe, and you correct me if I'm wrong, slightly different from your own, is from their perspective, World War II, either fought in 1939 or 1940-41, was from British imperial perspective a disaster. Should not have been fought.
Yeah, well, that is quite true. But the should not have been fought is not something you can then logically adduce from that. I think that almost certainly there had to be a war at some point, which Hitler's Germany had to lose for the good of Europe and indeed for the good of Germany. And I think that this was something which anybody could foresee. The question is what shape that war would take and who was going to win it. The problem with the 1939 war, which Britain and France confected out of more or less nothing, was that they pretty much lost it. And in France's case, they were subjugated. In Britain's case, they were only saved from subjugation. We, I should say, were only saved from subjugation by the wonderful English Channel, for which I give thanks daily. But that was all that saved us. We certainly didn't have the land army which could have fought off a German attack if we hadn't had the Channel. And so what was the point of that? But that doesn't mean you shouldn't ever go to war or be prepared to go to war. It raises all kinds of other actually now counterfactual questions, which I'm not really concerned with. What I am interested in is the Polish guarantee, particularly, given, in fact, that the Czechs had a far better case and Germany had a far worse case over Sudetenland than Germany had over, for instance, Danzig or the Corridor. It's odd that we didn't go to war over Czechoslovakia, but we did go to war over a matter which probably could have been settled diplomatically if we'd taken a different view. Why choose Poland? And why choose September 1939, when Britain was not at all ready for a continental land war, to go to war? These are questions which I think are worth asking.
Now, getting back indeed to the guarantee of Poland by the Western powers in the spring of 1939. For you, this is a mistake, a strategic mistake of the first magnitude. Correct me if I'm wrong, because A, it gave the initiative, diplomatically speaking, not to the British and the French, but in fact to Colonel Beck's Polish foreign minister's hands. And second, of course, is that both powers ended up circa September 1939, entering the war prematurely. Is that the gist of your argument?
Yes, and what's more, it was fantastically dishonest. I mean, it did give Poland the choice and the control over when or whether a war began. And it was fantastically dishonest on our part because neither France nor Britain had any intention of intervening in any material way to help Poland. Though the guarantee was militarily empty, and all the high command knew this, and they informed their political leaders of it. And the only people who seemed to have taken it seriously were the Poles. The Germans didn't take it seriously. I don't think the Soviet Union took it seriously. It's absolutely for certain that the British military command didn't take it seriously and the French military command didn't take it seriously. But the Poles actually believed we would come to their aid and based their diplomacy on this belief. And as a result, and the great question which A.J.P. Taylor asked, would you rather have been a betrayed Czech or a saved Pole? And what happened to Poland as a result of its deciding that it would defy Germany over the corridor in Danzig was that it was wiped from the map for several years and subjected to the most appalling horrors, which still resound. And what was the point of that? The whole episode seems to me to sink. And both from the point of view of Poland and from the point of view of the powers which made the guarantee, and indeed from the point of view of the result, which, as I say, without the English Channel would have been the defeat of France and Britain by Germany and possibly, quite possibly permanent control of Europe by a national socialist Germany stretching on for decades. Who can tell? It was very close to being a much worse disaster than it was.
Am I correct in believing from what you write in the book that you're not, how should I put it, very enthusiastic about Colonel Beck's Poland?
I'm not very enthusiastic, but what I'm saying is that you can't make out a particularly strong ethical case on behalf of Poland. Poland had at that time become more or less a military dictatorship. It had a strongly anti-Semitic character, not in the way that Nazi Germany was, but certainly Jews in Poland had what I think could be reasonably described as a second-class citizenship, and were often treated quite badly. And also Poland had taken part in the disarmament of Czechoslovakia, an act which infuriated France, and particularly Daladier, who was livid about it, and which made a lot of people very hostile towards Poland. The idea that it was at that point a bastion of democracy which needs to be saved by other democracies doesn't add up either. I just raise these points because they tend to be assumed as being the case by people, that we went to war to save another democracy, that we went to war for an ally. But in fact, Poland had been one of the first countries to sign a non-aggression pact with Hitler's Germany and had been on the point of renewing it. And, as I say, had been encouraged by Germany to grab Teschen from Czechoslovakia when Czechoslovakia was prostrate after Munich. So it wasn't, there's no emotional case for rushing to Poland's aid in this matter. And what's more, there was no strategic or military case either. The reason, as far as I can establish from what reading I've done on this, is that the British Foreign Office was strongly driven by a desire to reestablish and reassert Britain's status as a great European power. And they wanted a pretext to do so. I think they believed at the time that any new conflict in Europe would be a rerun of the First World War, in which we were able to blockade Germany and the French would provide the troops. And the problem with that was it was a poor calculation in the first place, but a complete miscalculation once the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact had happened at the end of August 1939, which rendered our entire strategy empty. But we went ahead with it anyway.
Now, in the book, you rely a great deal upon a book written around 30 years ago by Simon Newman, March 1939, The British Guarantee of Poland, which actually I have in front of me. I've enjoyed reading a couple of times this book. I did get this sense, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you disagree a little bit with his thesis, which was that the British change, very sharp turn in March and April 1939 on giving the guarantee to Poland, he seems to indicate that it was Foreign Office and Halifax, the Foreign Secretary's concern that if Poland was not offered a guarantee, Poland would be potentially browbeaten, pressured, forced into an alliance with Germany of some type.
Well, I don't know about forced. I mean, I think that he was. I think that the grave danger about Poland was that it could be cajoled into an alliance with Germany.
Or if you like, cajoled.
There had been a lot of conversations between von Ribbentrop and Beck. And indeed, between I think Hitler and Beck at one point on this subject, and all kinds of blandishments involving bits of Ukraine and all kinds of other things were being offered. So I don't think that it was a question of being browbeaten. They didn't trust Poland to become an ally of Hitler.
Right.
So I don't disagree with that at all. No, I think that's there was a great fear, and the guarantee was given partly to put an end to that fear. There was a great fear that Poland would fall into the Hitler camp. And then if that had happened, what would then be the British pretext for going to war?
Or I think Nguyen would say that if Poland became part de facto or de jure of the Axis powers, then there would no longer be anything resembling a European balance at all.
Well, it's difficult. I mean, there was, of course, Romania, I think, would have been bound to become an issue pretty quickly. But I'm not sure whether you could really have persuaded the British people to go to war on Romania. I think that Halifax had become particularly persuaded by the age-old argument, which gets a grip on foreign secretaries, which is something must be done. And guaranteeing Poland is something, so let's do that. Because there was this feeling that we were making noises about standing up to Hitler in Europe. We weren't doing anything, and they were looking for something to do, and foreign officers do this to this day, and prime ministers as well. And I don't credit it with all that much thought behind it. You look at the characterization of British diplomacy in this period as a desire to avoid war seems to me to be almost completely wrong. There seems to have been a strong desire to find a war in large parts of the Foreign Office, and the way in which various scares about Poland and I think Romania as well were treated with enormous seriousness by the Foreign Office and indeed by Downing Street suggest that there was a desire to find a pretext for war, not a desire to avoid it. Certainly after March 1939, I think that was so.
But what would you say is the causation for this almost a U-turn between policy in September 38 about not going to war almost under any conditions, well, almost, and this different view in March and April 1939 where, well, as they're looking for a pretext.
You have to remember that's a very important thing about the Czech crisis. In general, Britain had pretty much conceded the point that the Sudeten Germans should be released from Czech rule before the whole business began. And indeed, there had been in Britain for a very long time, and there certainly was in educated public opinion, a strong sympathy for the Sudeten Germans, going on, one which had been held by people, quite prominent people on the British left, right back into the 1920s as a particularly bad element of the Versailles Treaty, which was not popular in Britain. So there was no great desire to go to war against what a lot of people thought was probably a reasonable reordering of Europe to avoid trouble. So the pass had already been sold really before that even got going. But they did realize when... And you could argue endlessly about what happened in Prague in March 1939. And H.J.P. Taylor is very good on this, because basically what it was a collapse of the rump of the Czech state, which caused President Hutchin not to be summoned to Berlin by Hitler, but to ask to be received by Hitler in Berlin and to travel up voluntarily, because the rump Czech state was unsustainable and was falling to pieces, and into that vacuum of power Germany moved. But that having been said, of course, at that point it became clear to the British government that if there was anything was going to be done about Germany, that had to be done soon, and they needed a pretext. And I think the events in Prague in March 1939 simply caused the British government to believe that it was going to have to go to war pretty soon, and that it needed a reason which it could put towards the British people, who were at that time, I think, still pretty reluctant to be involved in a war. And they needed a cause, and I think they didn't want to look as if they were seeking a war. One has to remember a crucial fact about the Second World War. The declaration of war on Germany was made by Britain and France, not the other way around.
Correct. In the book, you say that World War II was two distinct conflicts. What do you mean by that exactly?
Well, the first conflict was the Anglo-French war with Germany, allegedly over Poland, which France and Britain then lost. And the war was sort of maintained in escrow for a while by Britain, which did not make peace with Germany, rightly did not make peace with Germany, in my view, and stayed in the fight, but quite unable on its own to return in force to the continent of Europe, and conducting the war in remote places, such as North Africa, rather than in direct contact with the enemy. And we kept the war alive, and then the war was taken over in 1941, first of all by the Soviet Union and by the United States, which employed the war for another wholly different purpose. And Britain remained on the winning side, but very much as a junior partner, particularly after the Tehran Conference, and was more or less told what to do and had no real say in the outcome, and was, while officially accounted to be a victor, very uninfluential in the final settlement of it.
As
for France, we had to pretend that France hadn't lost for the sake of French morale. I don't think that was a bad thing, but France was also welcomed back into the ranks of victors, although it too had been
obviously it was a loser insofar as occupied.
I'm sorry?
Obviously not really a victor insofar as occupied
But on the other hand, the French army did take part in the defeat of the German forces in Western Europe and in the advance on Germany, because it was psychologically important for post-war France for that to have taken place. But Britain played a very large part in the D-Day landings in Normandy in 1944. But from that point onwards, the American contribution, and indeed American command and political influence, became, I think, overwhelmingly more important than British in military and political terms. So that by the time the Germans were finally defeated, Britain was a junior partner at the conference table.
Going back to 1940, is it not the case that there is some empirical evidence that in late May 27, 28, 29, that Churchill entertained to a degree asking Mussolini for terms?
I'm not sure whether Churchill did. I'm sure you have better information than me. I'm pretty certain that Halifax was interested in it.
Yes.
But I'm not sure how. Churchill may well have been aware of this, but I think that pretty rapidly he understood that if you pursued that line, once you ask for details, you're on the railway line. Which leads to the Forest of Compiègne. You don't want to know the details, because once you do that, you've exposed the fact that you want to stop fighting. And I think Churchill understood very quickly that the moment we started talking about stopping fighting, it was over. You couldn't keep up national morale. You couldn't carry on with all the privations and difficulties and terrors of continuing with war. You had to fight on, or in the end you would end up making a dishonorable peace. So the idea may have crossed his mind, but I think the great thing about Churchill was that it left his mind again pretty quickly, whereas I'm not at all sure that's so about Halifax.
But isn't it the case that I suppose in retrospect, post facto, you can say romantic and emotional arguments and terms that Churchill approached that issue, and subsequently the war cabinet and the British people, are the same romantic and emotional terms that they approached the war post 1945?
Which wars post 1945?
Well, in terms of how they view the Second World War overall.
Well, I don't know. I think that you have to enter into any discussion of this, the unique nature of the German National Socialist regime. And this was not just a government of an aggressive military power. It wasn't just a standard issue Central European despotism. It was something special. And I think it was important that it was defeated both militarily and internationally, and defeated in such a way that regime did not survive. And I still think, from the point of view of human civilization, that was a good thing. But it doesn't necessarily mean that means you have to endorse every single action that was taken in the World War II, which did actually happen. I think some very serious mistakes were made. We could have done a lot better if we'd been a bit more cautious about how we behaved. We should never have been in a position in 1940 where we, one of the world's greatest empires, were on the point of considering opening peace talks with Hitler. It's appalling to think that we should ever have even been in that position. With our army standing up to its armpits in salt water at Dunkirk.
Yes.
And that was a very close-run thing. If Hitler had captured the British army at Dunkirk, I don't think we could have fought on with that many hostages in his hand.
Perhaps not.
It seems to me to be unlikely. I mean, with the nucleus of the new army and indeed that many people in the hands of a ruthless enemy puts you in a very, very hard negotiating position.
Correct. In your discussion of that period, you go a little bit into the whole genesis of the guilty men school of Michael Foote et al., and you point out the hypocrisy of the fact that all of these authors were from the political left, and of course the British political left had, if not been necessarily what we call appeasers, were most definitely adherents to opposing what they characterized as, quote, an imperialist war, unquote, and therefore...
Oh, completely. It's a crucial part of the British World War II myth that the left pretend to themselves that they were tough and principled in an era when they were the reverse, basically.
But isn't also another aspect of the hypocrisy of the entire argument or thesis or book, however you wish to describe them, Foote et al., is that we found out many years subsequently that the genesis of the book received backing, obviously sub rosa variety, from none other than Lord Beaverbrook, who of course was a out and out appeaser, and who we learned in 10 or 15 years ago had one senior cabinet minister, Sir Samuel Hoare, one of Neville Chamberlain's senior colleagues, on a retainer. He was giving him monies so that Sir Samuel could enjoy a proper livelihood as cabinet minister.
Well, a lot of that went on at the time. Of course, Winston Churchill was also in receipt of money from all kinds of people at the time. These days, if such things went on, they'd all be hounded out of office, I imagine, but it didn't happen then. But I Beaverbrook was fickle. I don't think that... I'm not sure it's really central to any argument I'm having what Beaverbrook did or didn't do.
Can you tell us how the UK was impoverished by what was called cash and carry?
Oh, we were not that well off in the first place. Our economy had been very badly damaged by the First World War. We moved from being a major creditor nation with huge foreign investments and enormous reserves into being a debtor nation, which then, and this is the most crucial thing, had then defaulted on its war debt to the United States, which I think was 1934. And when we had an economy which was not really very well positioned to gear itself up for war, we had important labor shortages in various skilled areas, and important, I think, machine tool shortages and other things, which made it difficult for us to produce war materials ourselves without importing both raw materials and machine tools. And so we were very dependent on the United States for war supplies. And the United States was not prepared to give us anything on credit because of the neutrality acts. It had to be cash and carry. And in the early stages of the war, the cash was basically sent across in secret convoys in the form of gold bullion and negotiable securities. And it was sent across to Canada initially and then passed on down to the United States. And we ran out of money. There simply wasn't any more money to pay for the war. And at the time, in 1940 when the Lend-Lease Bill was proposed and began to go through the Congress under the interesting title of House of Representatives Bill 1776, I think the then Secretary of Treasury, Henry Morgenthau, had to go down to the Senate and say to the senators, look, these guys don't have any money left. We've checked. We've audited them. And if we don't help them, then they'll have to stop fighting. So this actually happened, and we were broke, and there was the British ambassador actually said this to a group of American journalists, sorry, boys, we're broke, it's your money we need, and got into some trouble for saying it, but it was true, and it led to some considerable bitterness between Britain and the United States at the time and later.
Can you recount for us FDR's request to Mackenzie King, the Canadian Prime Minister, in the summer of 1940 concerning the British fleet?
He seemed to be, it's a very elliptical conversation, but what it appears to be suggesting is that whatever happens, if Britain loses the war and the Germans invade or we surrender, that whatever happens somehow or other, some way must be found of bringing the British fleet under American control and into American ports. It's a fascinating conversation. It's done through intermediaries, but it seems to me to it's a perfectly reasonable thing for him to have done. We did something very similar to the French about the same time, and when they didn't play, we opened fire on their fleet at Merville-Cabir. So it's just an interesting. It seems to me I'm sure that specialists have known about it for some time. It was interesting to me to read just how ruthless FDR was prepared to be in getting hold of the British fleet and making sure it didn't fall into the hands of Germany.
Can you expand on your statement that Hitler, in fact, did not have any concrete plans to invade Britain in the summer of 1940?
Well, I don't really need to expand on it. There are no such plans. None were ever made. The Germans didn't ever possess a single landing craft. The German Navy and the German Army could not agree on the size and scale and nature of the invasion. Navies and armies always disagree about invasions for rather obvious reasons. One wants a broad front, one wants a narrow one. And they never did agree. And it's fairly clear from documents which I quote in the book that at a fairly early stage in the summer of 1940, the German High Command carried on talking about an invasion mainly for propaganda purposes rather than because they actually intended to carry one out. They assumed that they would terrify and demoralize and disrupt us into making peace rather than actually having to risk that fantastically difficult thing, an invasion across the sea. These can go wrong however good you are. And why would they have done it? The other thing is there's no real evidence that Hitler ever had any particular interest in Britain at all. It wasn't central to his plans. And one of the things about the Second World War is that we in Britain like to think that we were at the center of it and Hitler's main enemy. But in fact, once Britain and France had been knocked out in 1940, the Germans had only one concern, and that was the Soviet Union.
Why was the Atlantic Charter an anti-British document?
Well, because it contained all kinds of provisions which undermined, in implicitly or in some cases explicitly, Britain's continued possession of an empire, and also it undermined Britain's then continuing habit of behaving as if it controlled the oceans. It wasn't allowed to do so, and there are a number of things in the document which examined and which Mahatma Gandhi in India immediately saw. Were clearly hostile to the continued existence of the British Empire. And whether just how conscious Roosevelt and his advisors were when they drafted these clauses that it would have this effect, I'm honestly not sure, but they certainly do. It, as a document and as an event, it was the most fantastic disappointment, both to Churchill and when they found out about its contents, to the British people. And yet it's portrayed in history as a great sort of shoulder-to-shoulder, hands-across-the-sea moment of brotherhood. It was nothing of the kind.
Why was the British defeat, or if you like, debacle in Singapore in early 1942 so important?
Well, it is probably the greatest single defeat of British arms in our entire 1,000-year history. And also because it exposed us to the derision of the Asian nations who had previously thought us invincible and then saw us being marched off into captivity by the Japanese. and realized that not merely could we be defeated, but we could be defeated by Asians. And I think that the moral effect of that on the future of the British Empire was catastrophic. We had lost our standing, and we had lost our psychological power, and we never regained it. The British Empire ended at that moment, I think. But leaving aside all the horrors of what happened to the captured troops.
Why, in the book, you don't mention what perhaps in retrospect is the greatest British success in the war, the Ultra Machine, a machine or a tool which some historians posit reduced the war by at least 1 or 2 years?
I don't know how you can make a calculation of that kind. I simply don't know. It's become a huge factory of new popular historical writing. But I'm not convinced of the real value of these things, I'm afraid. I don't think it can be really calculated that it made all that much difference. It didn't save us from being defeated in 1940. And I doubt very much whether it made much difference to anything else either. Who knows? I mean, I just feel that we make a great big fuss about this. Wars are won and lost by infantry.
Not by
fighting. Infantry and tanks fighting. I mean, the thing that, you know, you can go on and on about Ultra, I don't know, who knows, whatever claims you want to make, I don't know, maybe it did, but it seems to me that the thing which decided the war in Europe was the Red Army. Like it or not, I don't like it, but it's undoubtedly true. Without the Red Army, we would have lost it, and however many Ultra...
in essence, everything else was secondary to the
broken.
Red Army.
I don't think it can be denied. This was the point at which the military power of Germany was broken. It was broken at Stalingrad, and it was broken at Kursk, and it continued to be broken all the way to Berlin, and that's what decided the war. It may be if the Red Army had failed that some other force might have been able to do the job. But the fact is, they did do the job. And it galls me to say it, because this was the army of one of the most unpleasant despotisms ever to govern any part of the earth. But they were our most crucial allies, and that they were the ones who destroyed the German army. And the German army was no mean army. It was a very powerful and effective fighting formation, and I'm not sure whether anybody else could have done it. Certainly nobody else did do it. There was a lot of very fierce and brave fighting on the other flank, but I don't think it's really very easy to argue that it decided the outcome of the war.
Why do you believe Bomber Harris's bombing campaign was a mistake, both practically as well as morally?
Well, I think all the post-war research shows that its effect on the German war effort was pretty feeble. And I think that it was grotesquely immoral. And I wouldn't, even if you could show that it had a greater military effect than it had, I would still be against it. Because it just doesn't seem to me that civilized nations can deliberately drop high explosive and incendiaries on women and children, which is what we did. Can't do it. It's against all the rules of Christian civilization, and that is what we did. We did night after night after night after night after night. It wasn't just Dresden, the one everybody's heard of. It was dozens of towns, which huge piles of rubble on which great masses of blue bottles settled because of the corpses and distraught women carrying the baked, shriveled bodies of their babies about on trains and human fat running in the streets. I mean, it was the most appalling thing. I mean, there were worse things done during the Second World War, and we all know they were terrible and they were worse. But that doesn't mean that we can stand aside and say, well, actually, because those terrible things were done by the other side, that we mustn't condemn or criticize any wrong things which we did.
In your conclusion, you discuss the contrasting war trilogies of Even the Wall and Olivia Manning. I was curious,
yes,
why you didn't also discuss his three novels on the subject of Anthony Powell.
Fundamentally, because it never occurred to me. I don't find Anthony Powell that entertaining or interesting a novelist. I've tried, but I don't, whereas I find both Evelyn Waugh and Olivia Manning captivating and brilliant. Also, it just seemed to me to be very interesting that you had here two protagonists, both called Guy, both of whom ended up more or less in the same part of the world, and both of whose experiences reflected, I think, rather cleverly on the real nature of a war which we misrepresent to ourselves.
If you wanted people to take one thing away from this book, what would it be?
Please do not be led by pseudo-patriotic bombast into another war.
Well, with that being said, I would like to thank you very much, Mr. Hitchens, for being so kind as to speak to us today.
Thank you very much for asking me to do so. It's been a pleasure.
This is Charles Cotillo. Thanks for listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Thank you, Mr. Hitchens.
Pleasure.